Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Autonomous robots are not only found on TV. You could be seeing them in future biology classes as an innovative way to teach evolution. These autonomous mobile robots that simulate animal behavior are called biorobots. And here to tell us more about them and why they matter is John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College. He has a new book called Darwin's Devices: What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Professor Long, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Brian.
First of all, the whole idea of a biorobot is going to sound like an oxymoron to people. What is a biorobot?
Well, it's really a special class of robot that we build specifically as a model of an animal. And it's built to test our ideas about the animal that we're modeling it on. And it's physically embodied as opposed to something that you might put onto a computer.
And the biorobots that you create are modeled after fish. Why fish?
Well, I love fish, first of all, not just to eat, but I love them because they really are representative of our ancestry. Our ancestry as vertebrates, animals with backbones. The first animals with backbones were fish. So really, if you want to understand our history on this planet, you have to understand the evolution of fish.
And what do these robots look? These robot fish look like? Are they modeled to look like real fish? And once they're placed in water, do they imitate the behaviors of real fish?
Well, I think you've got a pretty good idea of it there. They do look like fish in the sense that they have a body, they have a tail that has the ability to flap back and forth and move the robot around a tank that we have in our laboratory. And one of the really interesting things that we're able to do is model the fish's brain in the computer that's on the robot. So what fish do really well is they can feed and provide for themselves, and at the same time keep an eye out for predators. So that takes sensory input. And we've been able to model the eyes in a special kind of structure along the side of a fish called a lateral line. And then the brain takes in the sensory information and is continually computing an output. And that output is what the tail does in terms of flapping around. You put that system into the water with a robotic predator there, and then what you get is the autonomous behavior that you referred to, which is not remote controlled. It's hands off from a human point of view. We just sit back and we watch our robots behave.
And yet those robots are still programmed to behave in certain ways and react to certain stimuli as threats, etc. But you go even further. You talk about evolving robots or evolvabots. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. Once we have these robots, these biorobots that can really mimic a particular animal, what we can do is create a population of them and allow that population to undergo the same kind of selection pressures that we expect might have happened, for example, 500 million years ago at the origin of vertebrates. And that selection pressure is very basic stuff. I mentioned feeding and fleeing from predators. These are really strong selection pressures for life, right? You got to eat, you got to avoid being eaten. And so what we have to keep in mind is that individuals don't evolve. It's populations that evolve. And so we have a whole population that is subjected to the pressure of a predator. This is a population of robots. And then kind of like an Olympic judging event, we judge who are the best at eating and avoiding being eaten. Those individuals that are the best are the ones that have a genome, a series of genes that represent the characters that we're evolving, that can be represented in the next generation through a series of random mating processes that occur on the computer.
So when you place the robot fish in a tank of water and step away, you literally let the robots evolve?
That's right. We're watching the game of life happen right in front of us. And that's those behavioral interactions among individuals that determine who gets to reproduce. And that's one of the really powerful opportunities that we have here with this new technique, which we call evolutionary biorobotics, is if you build a very good set of biorobots, You choose characters that you're interested in evolving. You can watch what selection pressures may have been responsible for the evolution of those traits. And so let me just give you an example. Here we are, animals with backbones. And we probably hate the fact that we have backbones because they cause us trouble, but this is a very important character early on in our evolutionary history. But the paradox is that the first vertebrates didn't have vertebrae. They didn't have these bones in the back. So where do those bones come from, and what might be the functional advantage that possessors of vertebrae might have had? And that's exactly the kind of question that we can go after with this evolutionary biorobotics approach.
So you and your students can observe the behavior of the robot fish and learn things about what might have been expected to take place in human evolution.
Well, that's right. If you go all the way back through our evolutionary history, believe it or not, by studying fish, we're really studying human evolution. And I know that sounds kind of far-fetched, but, you know, we have deep geologic history here, and this is uncovering a part of it. And one of the really great things about the technique that we have is it's not limited to studying fish. The general principles allow you to study any evolutionary event that you want to, including, this is going to sound a little strange, but why things might not have evolved. You know, for example, why haven't horses with wings, Pegasi, why haven't they evolved? And we can actually answer those questions by looking at selection, creating evolutionary events right in front of us, watching evolution happen.
My guest on WNYC is John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College. His new book is called Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. 212-433-WNYC and Wayne in Brooklyn Heights. You're on with John Long. Hello.
Good morning. I love this idea, Professor Long, because it can help us reduce the number of millions of laboratory animals that are used in universities, including Vassar. So keep it up. Good work.
Thank you very much. Well, what do you think about the potential for that, replacing laboratory mice with laboratory robot mice?
Well, you know, there are still things that we learn from the animals themselves, and that's part of what we do is we actually study animals like sharks. And then when we think we know enough about sharks to build them, then we try building a biorobot, and we use what I call the engineer's secret, which is if you build something and it works, then you understand it. So by building these models, we're actually testing our understanding of the animals. So do we use fewer animals? Absolutely. Is that the reason we do it? No, that's just a nice consequence of it. We really do it to try to understand life better. And this approach that we take is really a new kind of modeling technique that allows us to address questions that were very difficult to address before.
Do you think there are implications of this research for human autonomy if you're creating autonomous robots, and even what it means to be human?
Absolutely, and this is where the cognitive science part of what I do comes into play. You know, in cognitive science, we're interested in minds wherever we find them. And yes, we happen to find them in humans, of course, but many of us think that we find minds and mind-like behavior and intelligence in a whole variety of organisms. And one of the things that humans do, which tends to sell short other kinds of organisms, is we think that the whole key to intelligence and mind is having a big brain. One of the things that we're able to show with this technique is we can actually evolve more intelligent behavior, that is, more effective feeding and fleeing behavior, without touching the brain of our robots at all. All we're evolving is the body. And so it's a really counterintuitive thing for humans to think that intelligence is somehow part of the body. And where intelligence comes from is it's actually the behavior that's intelligence. It's the interaction of the body that has a brain, yes, with the world, and it's that dynamic interaction that really gives us this intelligence.
David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
So, first of all, I wanted to say that I went to Vassar and graduated in 1990 as a science major. And I think that the experiments that your guest is talking about are very interesting. However, I do want to point out that when he said that the scientists are deciding what is, quote-unquote, the best as far as survival is concerned, to me it sounds like they're setting up their own kind of selection bias not allowing time to tell who is actually the best evolutionarily, and putting the selection bias in favor of who the scientists think is the best.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. A critique of methodology, Professor Long.
Well, it's a good point, and that's not quite what we do as the way you described it, so I may have said it inaccurately. We actually test a number of different selection regimes, and what we're doing is trying to circumscribe the possible. That is, say, which kinds of selection pressures may be more likely and which may be less likely to have caused the sort of event that we're interested in. And truth be told, right, you can never know exactly what happened 500 million years ago, but you can say what was more likely or what was less likely based on this technique.
Thank you for your call, David. At the end of your book, and this could be a whole other conversation, but we've just got a couple of minutes left, you have a chapter about how robots are being used in warfare. If the goal is for robots to be able to learn and adjust once they're on the battlefield, what could that mean for the future of warfare? And could we ever reach a point where wars are won based on how many of my robots kill how many of your robots instead of humans dying?
Oh, boy. I think you're absolutely right. With the success of the U.S. drone program, we've really shown how to remove our soldiers from the field, and that's part of what's fueling this robotics arms race.
Although that goes one way at the moment, we need to point out. That's my robots killing your human beings.
That's right, but if I'm another country, I don't want to be putting my soldiers in the way of your drones, right? So I'm trying to build my drones right now. So that's to your point about, is this going to be a time when we have robots fighting robots? Absolutely. I think that's going to come up very quickly. Right now, most of the drones for the behaviors that matter, meaning trying to kill somebody, there's a human in the loop, so they're really remote controlled. A lot of their processes are autonomous, flying a drone, for example. What I think is going to happen next is we'll develop autonomy. Many people are talking about that. Increase the levels and kinds of autonomy that these robots in the air, on the land, underwater have. And then we're going to do things like, it seems logical to me, add in adaptive behavior. And there are machine learning routines that we already know about from other kinds of cognitive
science. But in 15 seconds, really 15 seconds, if human beings don't suffer and die, what incentive does one side have to surrender?
Stalemate. I mean, I think that's the only answer.
John Long, very provocative, professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College. He is the author of the new book, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.